This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the medical journalist Sondra Hempel, speaking with us today about the use of poison as a murder weapon and the 19th century origins of forensic medicine. Your book, Sondra, comes with the title The Inheritor's Powder, which is white arsenic and very popular in Victorian England as a means of hurrying along the reading of a will or the distribution of an estate. You begin the tale on November 1833 with the painful death of a wealthy landowner by the name of George Bodle. How and where did Bodle fall afoul of the fatal powder?
Well, as you say, he was a wealthy farmer living in a little village 10 miles out of London. And he fell foul when he and his immediate family and his servants all went down with a dreadful illness. At that time, that the symptoms that they had, stomach cramps and vomiting, were not that unusual, though, at that time, because there were so many cases of food poisoning around and other diseases such as dysentery and cholera, that to start with, no one was too worried. But then gradually the symptoms in the whole family worsened, and eventually they called for a doctor. And when the doctor arrived, he actually, for a provincial surgeon, was quite perceptive for his time, because he immediately decided that something very nasty was going on here, much more than a natural disease. And he immediately decided that the family had been poisoned, partly because of the symptoms, but also partly because they had all fallen ill at the more or less the same time, very soon after having their breakfast in the morning. Over the next few days, the doctor visited and tried to administer what little treatment there was for suspected arsenic poisoning. The rest of the family and the servants all thankfully recovered, but the old farmer, who was 79 and quite frail anyway, didn't recover. He died 3 days later.
And the death is painful and melodramatic.
Yes.
Describe it.
Well, it's absolutely horrible. The first symptoms, normally about 10 minutes after the person has first eaten or drunk the poison, begin with a tight feeling in the throat, which then becomes a burning sensation. And that burning sensation starts to stretch from the throat right down the gullet into the stomach. And then very violent vomiting and diarrhea begin. And this just gets worse and worse. And the vomiting carries on long, long after the person has nothing left to throw up, basically. So the strain that this puts on the blood vessels, first of all, is horrendous. And so people start vomiting blood. And then, again, the symptoms just go on and on until the whole body is affected. And eventually, people die of organ failure, really. The whole system just cannot cope with this terrible strain. But the symptoms can last from a few hours before the person dies, or they can go on for days. It depends partly on the dose, and it also depends a lot on the individual person and their constitution, really.
The scene in Flaubert's Madame Bovary, of Madame Bovary dying of arsenic poison, is a very violent one, similar, I assume, to the death of Bodle.
Absolutely. She's described as screaming horribly. And, I mean, being Madame Bovary, she sees when she takes the arsenic, she envisages that she's going to have this terribly romantic, peaceful death. And I think she says something along the lines of, there's not much to dying. I shall just take this powder and soon I shall be asleep and know no more. But of course, nothing could be further than the truth. And the Flaubert spares us no details, really, in describing her terrible symptoms and her screaming. I had no idea it was going to be like this. So it really is pretty dreadful.
But arsenic in 1830s in England is easily available. People can buy it in shops. It's very cheap. Talk about what white arsenic is and what were its many other uses.
What most people mean when they talk about arsenic is actually arsenic trioxide, a compound. And this was known in 19th century Britain as white arsenic, and that was the popular name for it. You could buy it over the counter with no questions asked, virtually no questions asked usually, for just a few pence. And it had a very legitimate use as a rat killer and also as a pesticide, insecticide. People would mix it with powder or paste and lard sometimes and smear it around the house. Very dangerous thing to do. But in order to try to keep bed bugs and fleas and lice and all this kind of stuff under control. So it did have a legitimate purpose, and that's why usually people bought it. But also the problem was that as well as being cheap and very easy to get hold of, it dissolves or disperses really very easily in hot food and drink. It's colourless in food and drink, and it's tasteless.
And on a grocery shelf, it looks like flour or sugar.
Indeed, indeed. And there were some dreadful accidents where people would buy white arsenic as a rat killer and then carelessly leave it around in a bag in the kitchen cupboard or the garden shed. And there were cases, particularly appalling cases, of children climbing up to the cupboard and thinking that they were getting hold of sherbet or something like that and dying from taking arsenic. So
in the Bodle case, which we'll get to, goes to a coroner's inquest and then to a trial, but it becomes a sensation in the British press. And in the middle of the 19th century, there is a panic about arsenic. I mean, it becomes people begin to worry in their beds at night whether their servants are poisoning them or the cousin that wants to inherit is doing them in.
Absolutely. One of the problems was that by definition, and because it's so it was difficult to diagnose, because as I've said, it was very easy to confuse the symptoms with other with perfectly legitimate illnesses, and because doctors had no reliable tests and really only the symptoms to go on, people just didn't know how many murderers were getting away with it. And it was that idea that firstly that you could be poisoned very easily by somebody near and dear, supposedly dear to you, or someone like a servant who was supposed to be loyal to you, which was a terrible idea, and also that people were wrongly going to their graves being diagnosed as having been the victims of food poisoning or dysentery when in fact they had been murdered. So that was a cause of a great panic. And as the tests for presence of arsenic in food and drink and victim stomach contents, as the toxicologists began to improve those tests and make them more reliable, instead of putting murderers off, which people thought that was going to happen, seemed not to do that, but by making it easier to detect when someone had been murdered, the perception was that this poisoning was increasing by leaps and bounds, and that's really what fueled a particular panic.
All right, take us through the story of Bodil. I mean, he's dead, and the doctor suspects arsenic, and then what happens? What are the procedures? What is the state of legal procedure of the police, of the attending physicians, and so on?
Well, this is some years before the Criminal Investigation Department, the CID, as it's known, was set up, years before the profession of detective came into being. So really, on a scene like that, where a attending doctor suspects foul play, then it really depended very largely on the doctor himself, whether he was interested in investigating further, whether he had the sufficient knowledge to do so, because forensics were just in its infancy, really. So, I mean, in this particular case, the surgeon, John Butler, was, as I've said, he was quite on the ball in diagnosing poisoning in the first place, and he set about collecting samples, forensic samples, which was quite an unusual thing for a doctor to do at that time. And he suspected that the coffee that the family had drunk in the morning had been tampered with, and he managed to get hold of some of the dregs of that coffee. And he also got someone, one of the servants, to collect some of the old man's vomit while the old man obviously was still alive, because he started collecting these samples almost immediately he arrived. And he also started questioning the family and extraordinarily, just like a detective, really, took notes, wrote down what their statements. And as soon as the old man died, he then went to give the information to a magistrate. That was the procedure, that you informed a magistrate. And
But the deceased had rewritten his will not long before he died, and it was a substantial estate. I mean, worth, $2 million in our day's money, and so a lot of suspicion spread across the possible inheritors.
Absolutely. The will is rather shrouded in mystery. What we do know is that extraordinarily, about 4 days before the old man fell, the family fell ill, George's son-in-law, Samuel Baxter, who'd married George's daughter, Mary Ann, took his father-in-law to his solicitor, and George rewrote his will. Now, we don't know what was in the original will, but George's son, John, known as Middle John, because he had a grandson known as Young John, Middle John said that he was under the impression that the previous will had left everything to him. But the new will certainly didn't. It left, I suppose, about half the estate to Middle John, the son. But the rest was divided up between the son-in-law, Samuel Baxter, his wife, George's daughter, and their children. So immediately this new will was highly beneficial to the Baxter family. So, and that was a very strange occurrence that this would happen just before the old man died, just within days, really.
So there is suspicion on Middle John, the son, on Samuel Baxter, the son-in-law, on Young John, the grandson. And is there is then an inquest, and a lot of the testimony is conflicting.
Absolutely. The inquest, the magistrate set off some inquiries, and after he'd spoken to several witnesses, he set up an inquest, told the coroner to conduct an inquest. And at this inquest, Young John, George's grandson, son of Middle John, was in the dock accused of the murder of his grandfather. And the reason for this, the reason he was there and not Middle John or Samuel Baxter, was because of a lot of circumstantial evidence. The young man had very recently, within just a couple of weeks before the family fell ill, had taken to the habit of going up to the house, the farmhouse in the morning from the cottage where he lived, supposedly to collect the milk. And he'd established a sort of bit of a pattern of doing this. And then the day they all fell ill, for the first time, he volunteered to fill the huge kettle from the pump in the yard that was used to make the coffee. And it was this coffee was found after some forensic tests to contain arsenic. And it was this circumstance, really, that put young John in the dock, along with testimony of one of his father's servants, one of Middle John's servants, maid of all work called Mary Higgins, who claimed that she had overheard young John boasting about how he wouldn't mind poisoning anybody, wouldn't bother him at all, and he would really like it if his grandfather died one day and his father died the next, and then he would stand to inherit all this money. So for those reasons, young John stood trial at... In the meantime,
the cause of death, arsenic, had been established. It had been by a man named James Marsh, who comes along with one of the very first instruments of forensic medicine to be developed in the 19th century.
Well, that's right. And Marsh comes into the story completely by accident, really. We know very little about him. He was just sort of too humbly born, and his work not famous enough to have left much trace. But he was a local man. He was working at the Woolwich Arsenal, which has a history of making weapons and ammunition going back for centuries, which is very near to Plumstead, where the murder happened. And Marsh was also was assistant to Professor Michael Faraday, the famous scientist who is renowned for his work on electromagnetism. And Faraday had this part-time job at Woolwich at the time, teaching young army cadets chemistry. And Marsh was employed as his assistant, part-time assistant. And although Marsh wasn't trained as a chemist at all, he appears to have the most extraordinary natural ability for science. And Faraday was originally approached by the authorities and asked whether he would test the coffee and the old man's stomach contents, because there'd been a post-mortem by that time, for the presence of arsenic. And Faraday, not surprisingly, had rather more important matters on his mind. And he said he couldn't do it, but he would hand the job over to his assistant.
All right, so Faraday's assistant, Marsh, develops an apparatus which establishes the cause of death as arsenic. And now, that is the conclusion also at the inquest, and now we have the trial of young John. And all the evidence seems to point directly at him, and what happens?
Well, yes, absolutely it does. But he's found guilty at the coroner's inquest, and he's sent for trial for murder at Maidstone Assizes, because the coroner's inquest is simply establishes that he has a case to answer, really. The jury decided he had a case to answer, but the proper trial was at Maidstone Assizes. And there he stands trial. There, his main defence is, well, if you think the circumstantial evidence is bad against me, what about my father? Because his father, Middle John, as he points out, has equal motive and opportunity. And also, Middle John behaves in the most extraordinary way, because he's one of the first people, along with the doctor, John Butler, to go to the magistrate and telling the magistrate what his servant, Mary Higgins, is said to have overheard young John saying, boasting about poisoning people. And all the way along at the inquest, his evidence at the inquest and what he says at the trial, he seems to be going out of his way to get his son convicted.
All right, but the son gets off. He's acquitted.
He is.
At the trial.
He is.
I mean, the tale is a tale out of Dickens or Agatha Christie on the he's acquitted. But then, and he's a young man at the time, 24, and then it turns out, with an even more Dickensian twist, 10 years later, what is discovered?
Ah, you're going to ask me to give away who done it now, aren't you? 10 years later, a young man under a different name stands trial at the Old Bailey for extortion, and he's accused of trying to blackmail a butler. And the butler goes to the police, and the police set up a bit of a sting operation, and this chap is caught red-handed, as it were, and he stands trial, and he is found guilty, and he's sentenced to 20 years, to be transported to Australia for 20 years. And while he's waiting transportation, it's discovered that his real name, he's under an assumed name, and his real name is John Bodle, young John Bodle, whose whereabouts had been unknown for about the previous 10 years or so. He'd disappeared off the face of the earth, seemingly, quite soon after the he stood trial for murdering his grandfather. And when he's also, when he's awaiting transportation, he confesses that he had been the murderer.
And in, all right, that's in the 1840s, and in the meantime, the panic about arsenic spreads through the press, and we have quite a few other cases of arsenic poisoning in the middle of the century. But we also have, by this time, the first real forensic test to discover its presence.
Well, that's right. James Marsh's test, which actually was still in use with some modifications, but it was still in use right up until the 1970s. And, I mean, certainly in England, if you speak to retired doctors and you mention the Marsh test, they will quite often say, oh, yes, I remember learning about that in my training. So it really did stand the test of time.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Sandra Hempel, for speaking with us today about white arsenic and forensic medicine in Victorian England. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2013.